everybody. Welcome to the Dimebag Podcast. I'm Tyler Wilkinson. We're here again with our full staff, including our staff writers, Megan Bard.
Hello.
And Peter Bard.
Hello.
And our football writer, Russ Steinberg.
Hello.
And our producer, Alex Cohen.
Hello, hello.
So I guess a good place to start is yesterday, the basketball season unofficially kicked off with UConn's exhibition win over Tampa in Gamble. I was there covering the game, and Alex, you were there watching the game, too.
Yes, I was. You can only take so much from these exhibition games. You can't read too much into anything. I'm trying not to read too much into Brima's borderline no-show yesterday. And I also want to not read too much into Miller. I was really excited about his performance, but, you know, it's a long season. But I do think that he's got some really great tools.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with, you know, looking at stats in an exhibition game is pretty pointless, but with Miller out there, you could really see, I mentioned this at first night too, but he's way more athletic than I was expecting. You know, a four-man coming out of Cornell, I was just not expecting him to be as quick and have as much bounce as he does.
I mean, I remember a couple of plays in the first half where he got his hands on like kind of a loose ball and immediately finds the basket or finds the pass. Yeah, he went to an Ivy League school, so he's smarter than I am. But also, like, it's very encouraging to see a guy who consistently makes the right decisions in addition to being able to use that athleticism well.
And he's one of my favorite types of players, which is a guy who can, you saw it on Saturday where he can put up, or Sunday, whatever it was, he can put up 16, 18 points in a game without having any plays run for him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they call his number a little bit.
He got maybe like 3-4 legit post-up opportunities. And I think, you know, even in those situations, he might have made maybe one hoop on I remember he made a nice turnaround bang shot. But it's him finding himself in the right position.
He's like a tiny Tim Duncan. That's what he is.
I was thinking, the two UConn players he really reminds me of, just in terms of skill set, are Kevin Freeman and maybe Donnie Marshall.
He's much more versatile than those guys.
Dude, Tyler, you and I were talking about that, and I was saying, well, is he kind of like Jeff Adrian? And you were like, I think he's more like Kevin Freeman, but he has that kind of imposing, presence in the post, but he also goes up really smooth.
He reminds me of Nadav. I know that's kind of heresy or blasphemy, but he kind of does everything well. You know, he's a great defender. He rebounds. He can play against bigger guys. He can shoot. I'll be really interested to see how he plays against big post players.
Right.
Because that was a thing that Nadav was weirdly good at. Like, he could defend against, you know, Alonzo Mourning and hold his own. So I'll be, like, when we go up against, like, some of the bigger teams in this conference, or when we play Maryland and he's got to defend Robert Carter, like, it'll be – he's a guy I'm feeling good about putting on those assignments.
Which is nice, too, because this was such an obvious problem last year, and really even the year before. Like, DeAndre was nice at a lot of things at the four, but, like, it wasn't like he was always coming. He didn't start leaving the team and rebounding until the very, very end of the season. So, I mean, having a dude next to Brima who still obviously struggles with that, it's going to be nice to just have that happening. And, like, I feel like whatever he brings in offense is, like, a bonus at this point.
I think his offense is going to be important. I think having somebody who can hit shots from the mid-range is going to give Bryman more space. It's going to give Hamilton more space. I got to say, that was the one thing that you said, Alex, that I don't know if I agreed with, that Hamilton was anonymous. He missed a few shots in the first half, but I thought he was much more aggressive on the ball than he was last year. There were a lot of times where he, you know, he had the ball out in front of three, and then he decided to actually penetrate as opposed to being – I feel like he was much more deferential last year.
I think it was more related to the fact that I thought that other players in the backcourt made a much bigger statement in that first half than I thought Hamilton really did. I mean, Hamilton, you're right, he drove and was aggressive, but I thought that Sterling Gibbs and Roddy Purvis and Jalen Adams all, they were more featured in the offense in the first half.
And Omar, too.
Omar, I have to single him out because I know that, you know, and when we like to look at stats and everything like that, but in terms of watching the game and looking at people play, I haven't seen Omar with that kind of intensity, I don't think ever.
It's the best game he's played since probably his freshman year. Maybe early sophomore year.
I mean, he was He had fire. He looked like he's like, I'm a senior. I want minutes, and I'm going to earn them.
He looks healthy.
I feel really good about our entire perimeter right now. I mean, if you figure between Gibbs, Purvis, Hamilton, Adams, and Calhoun, that's five guys who can all play, who can all handle the ball, who can all shoot.
Gibbs mostly running the offense yesterday? I obviously did not see the game. I was not.
Yeah, I mean, Gibbs and Adams mostly. Yep. But also Hamilton on occasion. Like, there were a few times he brought the ball up and initiated.
And Purvis on the break on occasion.
Yeah, how did Cassell look?
He hit it one really nice three.
I thought he looked pretty good, actually. You know, the thing when you watch Cassell, his stroke is really pure. And he shot like 26% from three last year.
That's daddy's stroke.
But you watch him even in these game actions, and it just does not make sense that that shot produces 26-28% from three.
No, I agree.
Well, if you remember accurately,
I agree with that.
The rims were tripping last year.
The rims were tripping.
They were fucking tripping as hell.
And I feel
I remember having that same reaction, Tyler, especially in the exhibition game. I watched Cassell and I was like, that guy has a really pretty shot. Like, clearly he's going to make baskets this year.
Well, remember the exhibition games last year, or the early season games? He had a few really nice games. Oh, I thought you were talking about these exhibition games.
No, literally what I was talking about. Last year, I went to the men's exhibition games, and that was the impression I came away with, was that Cassell looked really good in those two games.
He put up 18 points in that first one, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bunch. I just was like, wow, this kid can play. And then it was just like, oh. I mean, I think a part of it is he's probably not quite fast enough to really, like, really play at this level. But someone whose shot is that pretty should make more baskets than he does.
That's the thing. I mean, he doesn't have, I don't think, quite the point guard skill set that he's going to need to compete. So his role is going to have to be off the ball. And really, if he's not going to be knocking down shots, he's going to see his minutes go all the way to Calhoun and Adams. So, you know, hopefully he finds a shot.
I think he probably was a little more hurt last year than
we definitely for
a lot of the season. So, I mean, who knows? Who knows how that's going to play out? But I personally, I'm super excited to see Jalen Adams play. You guys got to, and I haven't seen him yet.
There's a lot to look forward to there.
He made some really, really exciting plays, but then he also made a few. I mean, there was a stretch during the second half where he couldn't stop giving the ball away.
Yeah, he's a freshman. I mean, and he... In several ways, he very much is a freshman.
That sounds a lot like freshman year Shabazz.
Or freshman year Daniel Hamilton. Remember those eight turnovers against West Virginia last year? You know, growing pains. One play that Jalen Adams had, though, where he caught the ball on a backtrack into the corner so he could bury a three, like on a back pedal.
He makes some really nice plays.
That was the moment where I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah, I texted to everybody. That was he just had a Ray Allen-esque moment.
Actually, when he hit that shot, because I watched the game today, I was like, oh, this is what Alex was talking about.
Yeah. But so now that we've talked about all the positive things that are great, Russ and I maybe should focus on the negative, because that's Russ's job.
Thank you.
I'm honestly pretty concerned about our stability at the five.
Yeah, that's... I wanted to bring up, because I know you can't take too much from the exhibition games, but I feel like what we saw from Brima, and I'm going off of like this tiny little box on my screen while I was watching the hockey game, so I don't really know, but you can tell against any opponent if he's not a lot stronger. You can tell if he's not rebounding like an 8-foot-tall center should be. I mean, those things are going to be concerning whether it's an exhibition game or not. So that concerned me. Hamilton, everything else, people have off games, but Brima was a concern.
Yeah, I think the thing that I was concerned about, I was looking forward to seeing Brima at the beginning of this year because I thought, you know, last year he came in having not been able to work out in the gym at all because he had a torn labrum. This time around, he had the whole summer to hit the gym and get strong Some skinny guys just stay skinny. That's just the way it goes. But he also doesn't really look stronger. He was getting manhandled by Division II bigs. Listen, to an extent, I mean, if Brima is just Brima from last year, it'll still be okay. You'll still have Miller banging around down low, grabbing rebounds, and it frees Brima up to commit to blocks and on defense, and that provides a different way of looking at it. But yeah, like if Sean Miller gets in foul trouble, or if he's injured or whatever, what have you. I mean, yeah. I'm telling you, Sean Miller's very important to us right now, because it doesn't really appear that Amita Brima is going to be much better this year at dealing with legitimate bigs.
Right, and that's actually the next thing I wanted to ask is, who's next in line off the bench? Is it going to be Nolan, who has the experience, or maybe Kenton Facey? You said Enoch doesn't look quite ready yet.
I think Enoch just had a bad game.
Fouls? Did I read that? Phil only got like 2 fouls in like the hottest of minutes.
Yeah, but everyone got 2 fouls in 2 minutes.
The refs
game.
Were
it was like
atrocious.
28, 29 foul calls in the game. It was. Oh,
was that the new emphasis?
I guess.
The illegal.
It's
looking
hard to even tell.
Ball.
I mean, a few guys. Rodney Purvis got called for a hand check when he literally had his hands up over his own head. So
yeah, I remember that play. That was the one that really drove me bananas.
I laughed on the sideline.
And that was the one where Gibbs got called too.
Same arms sequence. Arms were out to the side. After that play, Perv turns around. So it was the sideline ref who calls him. He turns around to the baseline judge with his arms still up in the air, and the guy just kind of shrugged at him.
Oh, Jesus.
Always a good sign.
Well, wait, I'm not done talking about Phil Nolan.
Go ahead.
The really nice thing about how good all of our guards and wings are right now is that because everybody pretty much can play up a spot. You know, Miller can play the five. He did that a lot last year at Cornell. Hamilton, we know, can play the four. Purvis can play the three. So you don't need a ton from your backup center. You just need one of Nolan, Facey, and Enoch to become a functional rotation big. You'd like to think that Nolan, by his senior year, can give you those. I mean, even if he's only as good as he was as a sophomore, that would be good enough. So you got to figure, like, one of these guys is going to put it together, and that's going to be a nice bench to have, you know, that one 18 to 20-minute big Calhoun and Adams, even if Cassell still sucks, even if, you know, Enoch's not ready and Facey never makes it back, like, we'll still have a solid bench.
I would wager by the end of the year, Enoch is that first big off the bench. He looked really overmatched and overwhelmed in the exhibition game, but
he gets in the wrong position. His footwork needs work.
He's just a freshman. I mean, Ollie and all the players say that he's probably the most attentive in practice. They keep calling him a sponge. You know, by all indications, they think he's going to start putting it together soon. It was just the first time he's ever played in this kind of situation.
Like,
he's
you can't
huge.
Teach that body, but we can teach you where to stand. Like, Kevin Freeman can teach you how to play defense. You can't teach how that kid looks. You can't teach athleticism. Like, he'll figure it out.
He's a giant person.
Especially if he's really, like, Kevin Ollie was, I got a quote about him saying, like, he's incredibly coachable. He wants to learn. He wants to let me coach him. Like, if he's really trying, like, he'll get there. Give him a little time.
And with but that hair, he's like 8 feet tall.
I love his hair. It's the most amazing. It's fantastic.
One thing I just wanted to, Tyler, what did you think of the 30-second shot clock?
I thought it was great.
Yeah.
I've thought been pushing for it for like, you know, 10 years or something. I've been clamoring for the 30-second shot clock. I think UConn ran up against it maybe once, maybe twice. They didn't have a single shot clock violation. I think Tampa had one, possibly two.
Great.
I think on both occasions that we ran up against it, we scored.
And both occasions, they would have run up against the 35-second shot clock, too. They were just not running a coherent offense, and that's what happens. And that's the entire point of running a 30-second shot clock, because these teams, especially last year, you saw it, they waste so much possession time. So if they can get an extra, whatever, 8, 10 shots per game up on a 30-second shot clock, it's going to do more to increase scoring than any of the new foul rules ever would.
Speaking of that, that was a difference in this game versus what we saw all year last year. I can remember a lot of instances last year where we were running down the clock, we were, you know, setting up plays and whatnot. These guards have an understanding with each other. I was very impressed with their interplay around the perimeter. They were getting plays quickly.
Yeah, they were almost too unselfish to a point. I mean, the ball movement, especially compared to last year, was phenomenal. And they would run. They spaced the floor very, very well. Brima would roll to the block. They'd push the ball up into the half court set as fast as they could with Miller trailing the play. The four, you know, Miller and the three guards would basically spread the wing and just swing the ball as fast as they could to get people out of position until one of the guards penetrated and tried to either kick out or get something inside. I thought they passed up a few open shots, especially Gibbs and Purvis in the first half, and Hamilton too, actually, for that matter. where they should have just launched from three on one of the kick passes where they tried to do too much. They were being too unselfish. But what was interesting is talking to Kevin Ollie after the game in the press conference last year with Ryan Boatwright there and a bunch of young guys, Ollie said he basically stripped down his own playbook, that that team was not capable of running the offense that Ollie had envisioned, and he had to basically dumb it down for him. So I was interested to hear if
that didn't work.
No, but who knows what it would have been otherwise. But so I was curious to know if those plays are now back in the playbook. And Ollie basically said they didn't run a single set play that whole exhibition game. The plan was push the ball as fast as you can and figure it out on your own. They weren't running offensive sets. All of that ball movement, all of the cutting, all of the passing was done freeform, basically, in the hands of the guards.
I used to coach lacrosse, which is a little different. But you attack the goal in a similar way, and it, if you just teach the kids, you know, this is how you respond in certain situations, they start to react, and they start to actually, like, play within the offense on their own, and you don't have to stop and set things up, and it moves much faster. And you remember that in the 90s when Calhoun was coaching, and that's why, you know, they'd attack so much more quickly, and they were so much more dangerous, and they could get at the, you know, at the beginning or the end of any shot clock. They always had, you know, somebody who was willing to go attack the rim.
Can we read anything into – so I think Ollie said something about he's still searching for his alpha dog. But
Tyler, I actually wanted to talk about that.
Yeah, can we read anything into the fact that they look so comfortable with each other? Do we think there's chemistry already?
I think there's chemistry, but I don't think there's a clear leader. You know,
because going back to what you were saying about – people giving up open shots. There were a couple of times specifically I noticed Gibbs
have a
look at the basket from three and not take.
And Gibbs is the guy who's going to be the linchpin on this of this whole team, I think.
I don't know if I want to say he needs to be the guy to take over the team, but he's our best shooter. He's our best scorer. And he's probably our best ball handler. He needs to be the leader on offense. When they are in offensive sense, he's running it, and he needs to be willing to take that shot. If he's got an open look from three, he should take it 100% of the time this year.
And there needs to be somebody in that role, whether it's him or someone else, because you're going to get to that point this year where you're at Tulsa and you're down, you know, two in the last 20 seconds. You need somebody to score. It should be Gibbs, who's done that at Seton Hall.
I will say we wrote about this too. What's interesting is just from looking at the team as a whole and knowing their personalities, Rodney Purvis seems like he should be the emotional leader of the team. He should be
absolutely
on
the locker room
just
leader.
On a pure emotional level. He should be their Kemba, their Shabazz, their Boatwright. The problem becomes Rodney Purvis, if he's shooting as much as Kemba or Shabazz or Boatwright, the team is going to falter. You know, the team needs to be more balanced on offense. So, like you said, the solution, I think, is Gibbs being that on-court leader that keeps the offense moving and keeps everyone where they're supposed to be. But it's a really interesting dynamic where you're asking a really talented guy like Purvis to be the team leader, but also to sacrifice some of his own productivity to remove himself from the offense a little bit. I can't.
Well, I think,
you know, it's hard to remember a similar situation.
It's hard to remember that, but I think it is Purvis satisfied by being the guy who can whip the ball out in transition and you know, motor up the court and set up transition plays. And when you set up the offense, it's Gibbs's turn.
Someone needs to be the person who distributes shots. Someone needs to take charge and make sure that the hottest guy in the court is getting the best opportunities. No one really stepped up and took that role. And Gibbs is going to have to go in and take it.
And he's in it, you know. He's in a situation where he's the new guy. You know, Hamilton and Purvis have been there, and both seem to be looking to take on more responsibility. It's not going to be super easy for him to come in and say, "I'm the leader." And, you know, like same thing like happened with Rudy Gay. Is he came onto this veteran team and he was the best player, but was he ever really the alpha guy? I don't know.
No. So Kevin Ollie played 11 guys in rotation the other day. How do you see that shaking out? Do you think he can sustain an 11-man rotation, or who do you think is going to be the 1, 2, 3 guys that fall to the wayside?
I would say at most 9. I've never seen a good team have like a legitimate double-digit rotation.
Well, except for Kentucky when they had 10 NBA players on the team.
Okay, and then you were running that platoon, and then by the end of the season, still, they dropped down to like 8-9 guys. I mean, people got hurt, but I think you're going to see, I could see maybe 9 guys sticking in regular rotation.
Cassell definitely drops by the wayside.
Yeah, I think you don't see much Cassell, and one of the big guys probably isn't going to get much burn. And depending on how things go, if Enoch gets it together, I think it's Phil Nolan. Because if Enoch is able to get in there and D up and do what he needs to do, Nolan doesn't really bring anything else to the table.
I will say the thing with the 11-man rotation is the way I see it shaking out is not necessarily playing 11 guys every game, but I could absolutely see Kenton Facey going on a one-week hot streak and then falling off the face of the earth and Phil Nolan having to come in and pick up the slack, and all of a sudden Phil Nolan's playing 12 minutes a game. And the same kind of thing with maybe a Calhoun and a Cassell. So, it wouldn't shock me to see all 11 guys getting a decent amount of burn, especially the back 4 or 5 on the bench.
It's not ideal game to game, but it's great to have that sort of depth. And I think what helps is that, with the exception of the freshmen, everybody played at some point important minutes, either last year or the year before that. And, you know, you hope Cassell is healthy and he could stay in it for a little bit, but even if he's not, I think UConn could hopefully have a ton of depth on this team. It's great to see.
And we saw last year when there was a need, a glaring need for 2 more real players, and they did not have them on the roster, just how important depth is as the season wears on. Yeah.
Another thing that everybody on the roster has to work on is free throw shooting.
Yeah, that was rough. That was a bad game from the free throw line.
Yeah, I mean, it's an exhibition, so you don't read too much into it, but unfortunately, some guys that did not shoot well from the free throw line last year also did not shoot well this weekend. So the free throw shooting, Glenn Miller, break out the old Steve Nashrill again.
Yeah, can we blame it on the Gamble lighting?
Oh my God, that's a great segue. Hang on. So we have a mailbag question from our friends at No Escalators. So every Friday we run the Dimeback mailbag where we answer at least 3 of your questions, shout you out, and do it again next week. So instant mailbag, our friends at No Escalators ask thoughts on MSG style theater lighting at Gamble.
Tyler, you and I talked about this before the game.
It's not sexy.
It's not MSG theater style because they don't dim it enough. So the crowd is like basked in this alleyway orange glow that only accentuates the tattered and peeling roof that they've neglected for 15 years. The whole place.
You can't replace those tiles, man.
Paint them. Do something. It looks terrible in there, and it's, you know, they ended up selling 7,000 seats or something, which is frankly great for an exhibition game the day after Halloween, but it just didn't feel great in there. So it'll be interesting to see how
that's such a bummer.
How the regular season starts panning out, but it's just becoming sad.
Yeah, I think it's totally fair to criticize that, especially in the, you know, Tyler, we said this in the text chain, but, you know, in the wake of the reinvestment into the XL Center, it's really it's disheartening to see that that's happening and Gamble is getting fancy LED lights that do a terrible job of lighting Gamble.
Yeah, it's a little disheartening. Yeah. I mean, especially they're talking about new on-campus hockey arenas. They just poured $40 million into the XL Center. We're in the middle of, you know, the debate about a new Excel Center, it's going to cost maybe $200 million, something in that range. And meanwhile, you have this gleaming, once glorious on-campus arena, which should be like the beating heart of the university, and it's just crumbling. It's being completely neglected, and it looks like shit.
And it's embarrassing when you watch. Yeah, and you see on TV schools like Louisville just opened up the Yum Center. It's not on campus, I know, but they play in these beautiful buildings, and you know, UConn does have the practice facility, which is nice, but that's not what you're seeing on TV day to day.
And they need to sell beer.
Beer's a given.
Sell beer in Gamble one season, you got enough to paint your fucking roof tiles.
Can I just tell you how much fun it is to go to a hockey game, you guys? I had such a blast at the Ice Bus at the XL Center. Like, it's a good time. I mean, and there's beer there, obviously. Pre-gaming at City Steam was a good time, and like, you can get really good seats, and I mean, granted, I was at a really good game. They beat BU. It was super fun, but Hockey is fun. You should all go. It's a really fun night.
It's definitely worth at least one trip.
Yeah,
it's a good time.
I'm going to the BC game. And UConn's goalie is very good. Nichols.
You got to watch him, man. Hockey
he was not good yesterday. All right, well, they lost 8-2 yesterday. It was kind of a disaster.
Well,
this is what happens when you go to the game.
I went to the East Carolina football game, and I went to the UConn BU game. They won both those games, Russ. That's all I'm saying. Maybe you're not allowed to go to any more games, and only I should go to games.
Yeah, are you saying I can't go to any more football games?
No. I'm not taking that one on.
So I was talking to Purvis signs his
contract. I guess let's touch on the one part of a sports weekend bonanza we haven't touched on yet, which is football.
Football.
Yay. So they got back in the right column with their win on Friday night.
That
Megan,
game was so much fun.
You had a good time?
Oh, it was such a good time.
Too good of a time that writing a recap of it proved impossible.
Actually, that had more to do with me like schlepping more shit this weekend. But it was an excellent tailgate. We did tailgate on a stick. Everything had to be on a stick.
Do you want
to
shout anyone out?
Well, it was my friend Christian and JP. I made some delicious chicken tikka masala on a stick. Go me.
Okay.
It was a lot of fun. That game was a lot of fun.
I think that was the best they've played all year.
They played so well. It looked so good. It was good football, guys. It was a good football game. An actual, real, good football game.
Yeah. I think they played more of a complete game in that one than they did even against UCF. I mean, you had guys on both sides of the ball who had career days. Arkell Newsom.
Yeah. He was incredible.
Jamar Summers. So OB.
That like 90-yard touchdown, yeah. That was amazing. We were just...
the longest touchdown run for UConn in 5 years, I believe.
It was phenomenal.
I saw some stat. He's like 16th Jordan in the Thomas? Country at the moment in all-purpose yards or something crazy.
The best thing
that sounds right.
The best thing about that run was right at the end. The guy goes to catch him, and he just pushes him off. Like, no, you are not going to stop me. This is not happening. Boom, and it was so fun. I do worry about Sheriff a little bit because like I don't understand why he won't slide. Like slide, don't...
He did it once against Cincinnati, and I think that was the highlight of the game.
The best part of that game.
Yes,
Russ, they're bowl chances.
All right, well they have to beat Tulane obviously,
right?
Because they're not beating two ranked teams to end the season.
So there's three games left.
Yes, Tulane, home against Houston, and then at Temple.
At Temple, who narrowly lost to Notre Dame this weekend.
Yeah, Notre Dame, I believe, is top 10 team.
Yeah.
So, if they don't beat Tulane, this entire conversation's meaningless. Got to win there. Tulane is somehow a 2.5-point favorite in that game. Yeah, I know nothing about Tulane football, but I don't understand that.
This game is so important.
Yes.
Because imagine what Paws Arf will be like if they have a chance to beat a very, very good Houston team and become bowl eligible.
It would be fucking great, and I hope...
I will lose my shit at that game. Like, if that happens, I will lose my fucking mind.
Yeah. Do we close the season against Temple?
Yes.
At Temple.
On the road.
Okay. But Houston comes to pause our... That's probably, like, really, that's probably the best bet is we beat Tulane, and then we beat Houston, we're bowl eligible, and then we go to Temple, I'm like, fuck it. Let's just go. Let's see what happens.
I mean, the thing is, the atmosphere would be so good at that Houston game if you know, bowl eligibility is on the line. If they pull it off, that just puts you a whole step ahead for next season.
One
the fact that we're even having this conversation, though, like the fact that this is even possible right now at this point in the season, like, do we remember where we were a year ago? It was sad and pathetic, and the football was unwatchable, and it was embarrassing and
well, hang
terrible.
On, because Russ is about to rain on your parade.
Yeah, I am. I'm sorry.
No.
Question. How much faith do you have in the UConn athletic department to make things convenient for fans?
Slim 5%. To none.
No. Okay. Now, the time for the Houston game hasn't been announced yet. That's going to be determined probably by ESPN or whatever network it's airing on.
Yeah.
I assume...
CBS Sports Network.
Probably.
Don't you dare.
I assume that this is why UConn has also not announced the time for the men's basketball game against Furman at Gamble.
Okay.
So all I was going to say is that Paws Arf might not be full because everyone's at the basketball game against Furman.
This is a really good opportunity to do what they did a few times with the hockey last year, which is the 2-for-1. You know, you buy one ticket, you get a football ticket for $5 or whatever, and schedule one at noon and one at, you know, whatever,
seven.
Six or seven.
Yeah.
And that bus is taking people there.
And we all know that's not going to happen.
I don't know.
I don't know that I mean they might get their shit together. For a game that big, I don't know. I'm not gonna rule that out yet.
I have to think that if you've got the basketball program which is drawing what it's drawing, and you have an opportunity to convert some of those fans over to Rentschler, that's an opportunity. The only reason I tend to agree with you is that it's the game is at Gamble and not this and not the XL Center. If the game was at the XL Center, you might have a better shot. But yeah.
The last thing we have on our agenda is just a light recruiting update. If Peter wants to fill us in on anything that's happening on the recruiting side of things,
there isn't much. He's made some 2018 offers now, which I thought was a little early, but I guess not that crazy.
So wait, let me throw some names at you, and you can kind of give a little update here.
All right.
Hamidou Diallo.
Is it Ham or Ham?
I don't know.
I've been saying Ham.
I've been Hamidou? Saying
Hamidou. Well, I guess that makes sense because it's Mamadou.
Mamadou and Hamidou.
But Hamidou fits with the Ham theme.
Well, that's
like Jean-Claude Dan Ham.
Let me ask you this. So when is he going to commit so that I can learn how to pronounce his name?
I don't know yet. I don't know because he's technically still a 2017 kid. I think he's waiting to decide. He might be trying to figure out if he's actually going to graduate this year. Like that, he transferred, and that's when he reclassified. So maybe he's going to stay in 2016.
When's the last?
Or 2017.
What's the last moment that you can reclassify to 2016?
Like the day before classes start. I mean, you can enroll in college.
He could do it next summer.
So he could be waiting to see what it looks like as it's going to happen at UConn. I mean, if Purvis definitely goes and if Hamilton goes, maybe that makes him reclassify. But if they don't, then maybe he waits a year?
Or when the Wizards hire Kevin Ollie.
If he's got a Kentucky offer, I don't know if the Kentucky offer would, if he could go early. I know for UConn he could. If he said, I want to reclassify to 16, he knows he can do that.
Right. And UConn's a big-time program who he'll be able to, obviously not hold the spot for him, but they'll have a space for him if he chooses to come.
Right.
Real quick, can you say a little something about Hamidou Diallo? What position does he play? What are his strengths? What are his weaknesses?
He's a super duper athletic two guard, long, like 6'4", but super super lanky. Just very very good off the bounce, gets to the rim, great in transition. Like he's one of those guys who's been kind of like Wenyen Gabriel, just sort of flying up the recruiting rankings. He's in the top 10 now, after being 50-ish a year ago. Everybody wants him. Kansas is after him. Kentucky's after him. But rumors are that he is planning on going to UConn. Supposedly he's told guys on the team he's going to UConn. But I don't know. I can't.
And Ollie's also already wrapped up Mamadou Diarra, his Putnam Science Academy teammate.
He's also been
talking to a couple other players on Putnam Science Academy too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he seems to be targeting that program as a trying to get some sort of pipeline out of there because there's a lot of talent coming through there.
Oh, yeah,
we were talking recently about how UConn should be filling out its roster if it has one or two scholarships left. A good way to do it might be to offer a scholarship to the teammates of some of these guys. I mean, that seems to be a way to do it. I mean, Wake Forest, for example, offered a two-star recruit who happened to be Harry Giles' high school teammate. Ollie should just start handing out scholarship offers to everyone on PSA.
Alpha Diallo
still probably be one of the four best players on Wake Forest.
Yes.
Well, and Marquette just did that to get Ellenson, the big man they just got for this year. They his brother got a track scholarship.
Recruiting's so fucked. Okay, I want a few more names, though, Peter. I'm going to throw some at you. Makai Ashton-Langford.
Yeah, definitely think that he seems to be one of the top priorities for the staff for 2017, and I would be pretty surprised if we didn't end up landing him. He seems to be very, very interested in UConn. I think it's also possible that he reclassifies. That's been discussed.
And one of the things you and I talked about at one point, probably in one of our staff emails, was sort of the way Ollie's been targeting these backcourt guys. A guy like Ashton Langford actually fits in really well with other guys like a Vance Jackson and a Alterie Gilbert, just in the type of offense that Ollie's trying to compile.
Well, yeah, he likes to get guys who have a lot of different offensive skills. You get guys who can both handle and shoot and try and get as many positions as possible. I mean, you remember the team in 14 that won the title, in large part won because everybody but the center could handle the ball and shoot. You stick a guy like Ashton Langford in between Gilbert and Diallo, and you've got a lot of different skills covered. There's not a lot of redundancy between those three guys, even though they're all guards. Jackson can play two or three positions. I think that's one of the things that was on the team in the mid-90s when Ollie was there is, you know, like that 94 team, you could take out anybody in that lineup and just bring in Ray Allen.
And Ollie loves to talk about positionless basketball.
Exactly.
Any other recruiting names, maybe someone you're hot on that we haven't heard a lot about yet?
Well, I mean, there was obviously the whole Zach Brown situation. I'm hearing more good stuff, and again, with Brown, I'm hearing that it would be very unlikely if we didn't end up getting him.
This is a bold move going back on the record with this.
You know, I've heard from sources that have been reliable in the past, and it's kind of getting out there a little bit, that Brown is heavily leaning UConn, and that the only holdup might be his guardian is pushing him to, you know, actually
to go on all of his visits.
To go on all of his visits and actually like go through the recruiting process, which I mean is probably good advice.
All right, anything else we want to touch on? Are we good?
No, done.
Well, thanks everybody for listening to the Dimebag Podcast. Don't forget, you can read our mailbag every Friday and check back every weekday. We're going to have new material, and we'll be covering the exhibition games going forward and also the football game next weekend. And until next time, we'll see you later.